Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordechai Joseph. We're today in lesson 3 or 4, and we are still in Leviticus 23 with the Passover. We're going to make a few more comments that are relevant to the events that have to do with the history of the event and also the prophetic history of the event. In other words, things that are going to happen in the future, which are a history recorded in advance. And that's the way the Bible is written. That's what prophecy is all about, in essence. It's history recorded in advance. And so all these holidays that I mentioned here have all these facets to them, historic events of things that happen, but also the prophetic events, which are, again, the history written in advance of all the things that are going to happen in the future. And so all these elements are the components of the plan of God, and most people are not aware of them, unfortunately, and therefore the knowledge of the holidays and the experience of these holidays and the observation of them are not as full as they were meant to be, because people do not know the Word of God as they should. Anyway, with the Passover, we have some other elements there that need to be considered as we read through that again. The children of Israel were in the land of Egypt. It is in Egypt where they were in captivity because of their own sins and iniquities, as we covered that earlier. And there God came to them, and He was about to deliver them, and He commanded them to kill the Passover and to eat the Passover, that He is, in essence, the epitome of it, because He symbolized it. He Himself passed over them in person when the blood was on the doorposts, which symbolized basically the passing over their iniquities and sins, and they were not killed, while the others, where the blood was not, to begin with, the lamb was not killed, and the blood was not placed on the doorposts, well, they had no atonement for them. And so their firstborn was killed. And so Israel went through that, and obviously the ultimate future prophetic event is the coming of this God of Israel that came down at that point and delivered them, you see, and passed over their homes. And this time He's coming in person, not to ask them to kill a Passover, but Himself to be killed. He allowed Himself to be killed. God caused it to be done that way. A lot of people, in their ignorance, they think, well, the Jews killed Jesus Christ. Nobody killed Jesus Christ. You see, if God did not allow it, if Christ did not allow it, nobody could have done it. So it's not something that people did. You know, people were instruments in fulfilling the plan of God. That's all they were. And obviously, a lot of people had wrong attitudes there. But at the same time, it is our own sins and iniquities of every human being who ever lived, including Adam and Eve. We are the ones collectively responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. So when some people pinpoint the blame on a small group of people, that shows an awful lot of ignorance on their part, and to begin with, the height of hypocrisy and bigotry on their part. And that's basically, unfortunately, what you find in the world of so-called Christianity. And they are the ones that are the most ignorant about this understanding of the Passover. And therefore, they acted in this manner in the past 2,000 years, putting the blame on one small group, when they don't realize every single one of them was guilty for it, just as guilty as those who were there. And after all, with all the persecutions they had against the Jews, there was only a small group of Jews that were there. The majority of the Jews did not even know what was going on there, had no part with it. Majority of the Jewish community at the time lived abroad. They knew nothing about it, you see. And all those generations that came later on. And so everything that transpired during this past 2,000 years in terms of putting the blame on the Jews, that basically was a satanic in nature. And that's exactly what was on the mind and the hearts of those people that had these kind of feelings toward them. They never understood the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the purpose for it, the reason for it, and therefore they did what they did. As Stephen said about his own people, God forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Lay it not to their charge. And so in Egypt, the sacrifice was offered, and the Passover symbolized the one that will come in person and not Passover just by walking over and smiting the firstborn of Egypt, but Himself, you see, become the sacrifice. After that, they were taken into the wilderness, And for 3 months they traveled in the wilderness, and they came before God, the one that passed over them, the one who later on gave his life for them. That's the reason why he did it. You see, people do not understand the law of God, do not understand what they read in the New Testament when it says that Jesus Christ is the one who is washing his bride to make her holy and righteous and glorious, without spot, without blemish. That's what he was doing there. 2,000 years ago, being on the cross, doing just that. And he was doing it for his wife Israel and the rest of mankind. That's the understanding of it. And people who have no knowledge of the law, obviously, have no comprehension of that. And so they stood before God on Mount Sinai, and he gave them the law and married them. There was a marriage ceremony there, and there was a wedding supper there, in essence. You know, the terminology of the wedding supper, which is coming in the future, hasn't happened yet. There was a last supper, but that was not the wedding supper. And there the blood of the New Testament was symbolically shared among the disciples as Christ gave it to them through the wine and the bread that he gave them. And this is what they had at that time. And so in Sinai, this is what happened also. They had the wedding supper there, where later on you read that Moses and Aaron and the elders of Israel, representatives of the 12 tribes of Israel, were commanded by God to come up to the mountain. And there they offered sacrifices, and there they ate before him, and he was right there, and they saw a part of the glory of God. They saw the sea of glass, they saw his feet, they saw a part of his back. You see, they did not see his face, obviously. And it says that the nobles of the children of Israel who saw that were not hurt by him. And that was, in essence, the wedding supper there. They, on behalf of the whole nation, were eating the wedding supper before God. And all those things have future connotations, obviously. You find in Jerusalem, the Last Supper, the 12 disciples were there, representatives of all the tribes of Israel. And in reality, they are going to be the rulers of all the 12 tribes of Israel in the future, as Jesus Christ promised them when Peter asked him, "What are we going to have? We forsook everything." And he said, well, in the regeneration, in other words, when his kingdom is set on this earth, when he comes back, and his disciples are going to be with him wherever he is. A lot of people, when they read those statements in the New Testament, since they've been taught the pagan doctrine of heaven and hell, they think, well, that's happening in heaven. He's not talking about that, obviously. They're going to be on this earth. And he said, in the regeneration, that is when his kingdom is set on this earth, and he reigns over the house of Jacob, sitting on the throne of David. You see, he's going to be in Zion, in the temple that is going to be rebuilt there. He said, you're going to be sitting on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So there you find in the first wedding supper, right before God on Mount Sinai, representatives of all the tribes of Israel that were judging the 12 tribes of Israel in that sense. They were their chiefs, their heads of their households, the elders of Israel. And they were sitting there. So you see similarities happening there in Sinai in the old days, and in the days of Jesus Christ. But that's not the end of the story, because again in the future you're going to see some things that are happening here which are all linked to this plan of God, of the Passover. So this Passover has many facets to it. Historic events of what happened, then future events where 2,000 years ago, which is 1,500 years down the road, certain things are happening again. You see, the ultimate Passover was paid, was sacrificed, and the penalty was paid for their sins and iniquities, you see, to pave the road for the future wedding with Israel. You see, that's the church, Israel. That's, again, a major blunder on the part of ignorant people who taught a false doctrine that the pagan church is that church that the New Testament is talking about, when the apostles and all the prophets made it very plain from the beginning. No, it's Israel, you see, and the few that were grafted from the Gentiles at that time and in future generations until the end of time, until the coming of Christ of the nations to become a part of the commonwealth of Israel. But it's still Israel, you see. And so it was the story. And so in the future, we're going to see a wedding supper again with Israel, and it's not only with the people of God that have been the saints of God and who had the Holy Spirit, who overcame and endured until the end, and Avistai and his coming, they receive the reward and they become spirit beings. You see, they are only the first fruit. You see, they are not the church. They are only the first fruit of the church. The first fruit are never the harvest. You see, they are just the first fruit of the harvest. And then comes the harvest. And they are all part of the same. You see, just like Jesus Christ is the firstborn of many brethren. And so, all the saints of God become the firstborn of many brethren of the house of Israel and of the nations of the earth. But they all become part of Israel. And in the future, there's going to be, again, another wedding with the people of Israel. And you read about that in the prophets, many places you read that. Let's go to Jeremiah, where we read some events that are depicted from the beginning of time, though not recorded, obviously, at this point, Leviticus 23. But you can see when you study the entirety of the Bible, you can put a lot of these things together, pieces of the puzzle, and you see a clearer picture of what was all this plan of salvation about, all these holidays here. And the people that just look to this chapter and study only what's in here, obviously they don't get much out of it, and that's a problem with the Jewish community. They don't get much out of it because there isn't much here when you think about it, and you've got to put the whole thing together to see the entirety of the picture. In the future, when God deals again with his people, he's going to bring them back. We're talking about the entirety of the nation of Israel, and that's scattered everywhere. We're not talking only about the Jews, we're talking about all the tribes of Israel. Another 10 so-called lost tribes of Israel, which are now scattered and in concentrated forms in many places. Northwest Europe, the majority of the people of Northwest Europe are all Israel. There are abundant historic records that make it very plain who they are. That's minus Germany and Austria. But all those countries there, Northwestern Europe, you know, the Scandinavian countries, the British Isles, France and Belgium and Holland and Switzerland and so forth, all the Northwestern democracies beside Germany and Austria and some others there, obviously not including the Eastern Bloc, Slavics. All these people are the people of Israel, and then, you know, their descendants and migrated elsewhere. Now they're in the Americas, in North America, and some went to South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and here and there and so forth. These are all the children of Israel. The majority of them don't even know who they are, and for that matter, an awful lot of the Jews don't even know who they are either. A lot of people don't realize that. Many of them lost their religion and became known now. Nowadays are known as Catholics or Protestants, and only very few of them know their identity. And we're not going to go into that at this point. That's not the point in this case. But just general information. All these people are going to be brought back to their land. And this is what God says about them in the future. This is what they are going to say. In verse 13, we read in the book of Jeremiah chapter 16, "Therefore, God is speaking here, I will cast you out of this land into the land that you do not know, neither you nor your fathers. And there you shall serve other gods day and night where I will not show you favor." Now this is talking about the day when God threw his people out of the land. You see, because of their iniquities and rebellion against him on a consistent basis. And so that happened for Israel, the house of Israel, the northern kingdom, 2800 years ago. And then for the house of Judah, about a century or more later on, where Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered them, and they too were thrown into captivity. And then they had their later captivity in the days of Rome. You see, and that God is basically, in this verse, talks about this whole period of time until our day. But this is what comes at the end in verse 14. "Therefore, behold, the days are coming." We're talking about roughly about 25 to 2800 years difference between verse 13 and verse 14. He says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that it shall no more be said," and this is what the people of Israel are saying and have been saying in the past, especially the house of Judah. Of course, Israel don't say it anymore. That is the northern kingdom. They lost their identity. But the house of Judah still does that. And especially at Passover time, that's one of the things that they are saying. That's what the Passover is all about, the Passover night for the Jews. They discuss the coming out of Egypt, and that's how they consider it, the time of redemption from Egypt. And they don't realize a future Egypt is coming, captivity, slavery, affliction, oppression, and deliverance, and the renewal of the marriage covenant. And so God tells them, therefore, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that it shall no more be said, the Lord lives who brought up the children of Israel from the land of Egypt. They're not going to say that anymore. Why? Because they're going to go through another experience like that, and the first one will be forgotten. Verse 15. But the Lord lives, this is what they're going to say, who brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands where he had driven them. That's talking about a future event. For I will bring them back into their land, which I gave to their forefathers. So far he brought only a few of them, just like he did in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Only a few of them that he brought back. So the overwhelming majority of them are still out there. And most of them don't even know who they are, including many of the house of Judah. And so he said, behold, I will send for many fishermen, says the Lord, and they shall fish them. And afterward I will send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and every hill and out of the holes of the rocks. For my eyes are on all their ways, they are not hidden from my face, nor is their iniquity hidden from my eyes. And so God first is going to bring them the punishment, you see, and after that he's going to bring them back to the land. That's in essence what he was doing in Egypt. You see, first he punished them through the captivity of the slavery, and then he brought them back out of Egypt as he promised to Abraham, and he took them as his people, and he married them, and he brought them into the wilderness. And so we are going to see something similar to that happening in the future. In chapter 20 of the book of Ezekiel, we read more of that. You have a synchronized history there, the entirety of the history of Israel from the days he brought them out of Egypt until the end of time, through this chapter of 20. And at the end of time, this is what God is saying about his people. We read it in chapter 20, and let's begin with verse 34. I will bring you out from the people, that is from the peoples, and gather you out of the countries, just like as we read in Jeremiah, where you are scattered. He's the one that scattered them a long time ago, and he's going to do it again, because they still are not behaving themselves. And so he said, I'm going to gather you from the countries where you are scattered with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with fury poured out. He's going to pour his fury on them one more time before he brings them again out of their captivity, their final captivity, into the land of Israel. You see, and then verse 35, and I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there I will plead my case with you face to face. You see, just like he brought them out of Egypt into the wilderness, and then finally brought them to Sinai, and then he had the covenant with them. They're going to go through a similar experience here. So this plan of salvation that is recorded in Leviticus 23 basically tells you an awful lot of these things. Of course, at this point you don't read all the details, but it lays the framework, you know, the groundwork for this future history of Israel and their God. And that's a part of the plan of God of salvation, which would result ultimately for the salvation and redemption of all mankind. And so he says in verse 35, he's going to plead with them face to face. He's literally going to be there and speak to them face to face. 36, just as I pleaded my case with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. You see? Now while they were in Egypt, and he called it the wilderness of the land of Egypt, because it was a wilderness of spiritual nature. And also, most of Egypt is a wilderness to begin with. And you have to study the whole chapter. Well, actually, we just went through it a few lessons ago, so you should know what's in it. And if you want to refresh your mind, just go through it again. And so I will plead my case with you, says the Lord, and I will make you pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. You see, that's a new marriage. That's a marriage that he was talking about in Jeremiah 31:31, and then the Apostle Paul mentions that in the book of Hebrews, chapter 8, the new covenant he's going to make with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, that's after the destruction he's going to bring upon them, which you read in many places, and Jeremiah chapter 30 talks about that, the trouble of Jacob, but he's going to be delivered out of it. And so God is going to bring them, the remnant of them, into the wilderness. Verse 37, and I will make you pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. You know, they constantly rebel against it. They're going to be brought under it. He's going to put this time his law in their heart. And then verse 38, he says that I will purge the rebels from among you. And those who transgress against me, I will bring them out of the country where they dwell. So he's going to bring them out of captivity. But they shall not enter the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Eternal, that I am the Lord. I'm your Master. I'm your Jesus. I'm your Savior. I'm your God. I'm your husband. They don't know it today. They don't believe it. They scoff at it. They have contempt for it because for 2,000 years they've been misled by their rabbis. You see? And to begin with, the children of Israel never even knew that because they don't even know who they are. They don't know their identity. So this time, God is going to open their eyes. And all that is in the story of the Passover. And so the Passover time comes. Had they known all these things, they would have read all this information with great understanding, comprehension, and would not have regarded it only as something that happened a long time ago. You see, as they came out of Egypt 3,500 years ago. But it's an ongoing story, in essence, in the life of the children of Israel, the children of God, the people of Israel, the wife of God. You see? And that's what God is telling them. And so in the story of the Passover, and there are many other things that we can bring up and talk about it, but, you know, we don't want to go forever doing it. And God makes it very plain that the plan of salvation that is mentioned here is a very involved one and has an awful lot of information attached to it. And so when we study Leviticus 23, if we have the entirety of the Bible in our minds and our hearts, then we'll be able to see the entirety of the picture there as we read everything here. And that's basically what happens once you have read the entirety of the Bible and you know it very well, then every word later on when you go back to read from the beginning becomes extremely amplified because now you see the entirety of the whole story. It's just like when you've seen a movie many, many times and you know every tiny little scene there, then you go back and you watch the movie. And now every tiny little detail that you watch from the beginning makes a lot of sense because now you see so much and you know the background, the context. You see? When the first time you see it, you really don't know what's happening for quite a long time until the end of the story. And so that's what the plan of salvation is. It contains an awful lot of elements there, you know, historic, ongoing, and prophetic, and future. And even that is not the end of the story because Ezekiel 37 still comes there for the entirety of the house of Israel that will be brought back out of their graves, not at the coming of Jesus Christ, the coming of the Messiah, the God of Israel. You see, a lot of Jews are totally confused about that. They don't know when the timing there. This is talking about the second resurrection, where the entirety of the house of Israel, whoever lived from the days of Jacob, you see, and his sons, and those who are not going to be in the first resurrection, we have not been called, we did not walk with God, all of them are going to be brought back. All those who lived since that day to that moment, that is 1,000 years later, that is the reign of Jesus Christ, the Sabbath, you know, the first holiday that is mentioned here in Leviticus 23. Then that happens, Ezekiel 37. The whole house of Israel is being raised. They're going to be brought before God. God is going to plead his case with them, just like he did 1,000 years earlier, as we just read here. And they too will become his people. So it's an ongoing story of the Passover and the fulfillment of it. And this is what we read here. And it began, this story began roughly 3,500 years ago. But it is going on for another 1,000 years. So it's a 4,500 year story until it's over. And so now we'll go back to Leviticus again, chapter 23. And we are now, let's say in verse 7. We read in verse 7, in the first day you shall have a holy convocation. So this is the first holy day of the Passover, and a holy convocation, that means it's a day where there is a cessation of work. They don't work on that day, you see, and when you cease to work, it's called Shabbat, Sabbath. So there is a weekly Sabbath and there is the annual Sabbath. And Sabbath basically means the time when you cease from work. The weekly one comes on the seventh day. You see, it doesn't come on the eighth day or the sixth day, as it is for Islam, on the sixth day, and for Christianity on the eighth day. Those are pagan days. Those are men-made. Those are chosen by men, not by God. They are not sanctified by God. It's not up to men to sanctify a day or to call it holy. It's up to God. God never sanctified any other day for a Sabbath but His seventh day Sabbath, you see? And His holy days, they too were called by Him, not by men, not by Moses, not by the Jews or Israel, by God, the God of creation, you see? They were called Sabbath, a day of cessation from work. And so He's the one proclaiming it. He's calling the shots. You see, that's the difference between the people of God and the people of another God. You see, the people of God worship Him and obey His voice. Others do their own thing. You see, and they can claim all they want that they worship Him. They don't. You worship Him only according to His instructions. And that's what Jesus Christ was telling the Samaritan woman and the Samaritans later on, and everyone else cares to listen. God is spirit, and He wants to be worshipped in truth and in spirit. And truth is what proceeds out of His mouth, not the mouth of men. And so God says, that day is going to be a holy convocation. That means a Sabbath. You shall do no manner of servile work. Don't go to work on that day. Well, obviously Israel doesn't pay attention to that. They don't even know who they are. And then the Jews, who are known today as Israel, the majority of them couldn't care less either. Only a few of them keep this law. You see, the majority of the people of God are rebellious. And for that reason, the horrible captivity is coming upon them in the future, which will by far will be greater than what they have experienced 50 years ago. And so God tells them, this day is going to be a Sabbath. That is the first day of the Passover season, that is a seven-day period. And that day obviously begins with the eating of the Passover. And that becomes the 15th of the month, because on the 14th itself, at even, you see, on the 14th itself, not the evening before that, just like you say, on the Sabbath, at even, that is the Sabbath in the evening. And those who understand Hebrew have no problem understanding that, and those who do not, they come up with all kind of strange explanations to it. And obviously, unfortunately, it's a product of ignorance and not of understanding, and many have done that. And so he says here, this day is going to be a holy convocation. Nobody's going to do any work on it. It's a Sabbath. So the context of this story at this point is the Sabbath, which is the first day of unleavened bread. This is not speaking about the weekly Sabbath, you see, because a lot of people got mixed up because they did not consider the context as they were reading it. And as we continue, we shall see the point here, where some people departed from the understanding of it because they forgot about the context. The context is the Sabbath, which is the first day. The context is not the weekly Sabbath. And so in verse 8 we read, "And you shall bring an offering made by fire unto the Lord 7 days for this entire period of time. In the seventh day is a holy convocation." So there goes another Sabbath, you see. So you have the first day a Sabbath, the last day a Sabbath, and now and then, depending on the calendar, there would be another Sabbath in between, which would be a weekly Sabbath. But the context here of this segment is basically the two Sabbaths of the Passover. He's not talking about the weekly one here. That was mentioned in the beginning of the chapter. And so when we have that firmly in mind, we're going to have a better understanding of what God is going to say later on. When people forget that, they begin to invent a different doctrine based on misunderstanding of this simple basis of this portion of the scriptures. We're talking about the first Sabbath and the second Sabbath, which are annual Sabbaths. We're not talking about the weekly. God was not talking about the weekly ones here either. Verse 8, this is what he's saying here. For the period of 7 days, you're going to bring sacrifice. And so the first one is going to be a Sabbath, which falls on the 15th of Nisan. And then on the 21st, which is the seventh day, you're going to bring special sacrifices there. And that day is going to be also a Sabbath, a day of cessation from work. You don't do any servile work. And so he says, and the seventh day is a holy convocation. God is the one that determines whether it's holy or not. Men cannot. You see? You shall do no manner of work that is a servile work on it. And so, again, you have another Sabbath. But we're not talking again about the weekly one. Verse 9. Now, this is what comes after it. And remember the background and the context. Verse 9. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When you are come into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you. Now, when is it to be done? You see, this is a ceremony they had to go through, and they've done it every year. And so God told them exactly when. And mind you, what was the context of this statement here? The first Sabbath, which is on the 15th, which is an annual Sabbath. It's a Sabbath, you see, but it's not a weekly one, but it's a Sabbath. It's holy, it's a holy convocation. No manner of work is done on it. And on the seventh one, again, it's another Sabbath. And so he's telling them that they're going to harvest here and bring the sheaves, the first fruit, before him. And so verse 11 again we read, And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you, when? On the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. Now, if you disregard the context and the background, you think, oh, Sabbath means the weekly Sabbath. Well, he's not talking about the weekly Sabbath. He just made it very plain. He's talking about the first Sabbath, and he's talking about the second Sabbath, 7 days apart, of the Passover. You see, this is the context. The Passover Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, is not here in the story. It was in the beginning of the chapter. It's a different part of the plan. You see, that's the first Sabbath. That's why between that first Sabbath, which he called it also one of his holy convocations and appointment, you know, special time for his people to come before him, then he repeated again when it came to the holidays. And verse 4, these are the appointed seasons of the Lord. You know, the same statement that he made before he began talking about the Sabbath. So the Sabbath is a part, you see. Now we continue the story with the Passover. So first he tells you about the Passover, then he tells you about the first Sabbath of the Passover and the seventh Sabbath of the Passover. That is the lion of the second Sabbath of the Passover on the seventh day. That's the context. Now within that context, he's telling Israel that on the morrow of the Sabbath, you bring this wave offering, you know, the sheaf, and it is being raised before God. And verse 12, And in the day when you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a he lamb without blemish for the first year, for a burnt offering unto the Lord. And a meal offering, therefore, shall... You know, well, then he tells you about the sacrifice there. But you see, at this point, way down the road, not at that time, not for centuries to come, you see, a controversy began to erupt among the Pharisees and among the Sadducees. The Sadducees were in charge of the temple. They were the priests. But the Sadducees, because of their Hellenizing and departure from the truth, you see, and compromising the faith, they were no longer trusted by the people, who turned in turn to other people who were more faithful, and those became known as the Pharisees. You see, well, in the beginning they didn't have any authority, but gradually a power struggle, you know, developed between them and Queen Alexandra, one of the Maccabean queens, decided in favor of the Pharisees, and so gradually they rose to power, and by the days of Jesus Christ they were well entrenched and in authority as the teachers of Israel, and the Sadducees were not. They were not trusted. And so the controversy between them was, among other things, obviously, you know, the Sadducees said, well, there is no resurrection. Well, where did they come up with this notion? There is no resurrection, you see. And that was a part of their misunderstanding of scriptures, because of their Hellenizing and because they departed from the faith. That's the reason, you know, among others, people of Israel did not trust them, you see. And so the Passover was another issue. The priest looked at that, the Sadducees, and said, well, it says on the morrow of the Sabbath, that means the weekly Sabbath. But that's totally out of context. You see, the Pharisee said no. And the Pharisee had a better understanding And how do we know that? Jesus Christ himself said so. He said, you, the Sadducees, you don't know the scriptures. Speaking by the resurrection. Know the power of God. You really don't understand the scriptures. That was their deficiency. You see, being priests, they had to perform the sacrifices. The Pharisees couldn't do it. But in terms of teaching the law, Israel would not accept them. Because they had no proper understanding. And they were, you know, because of their Hellenization. And they were not faithful. Not that all of them were that way. Obviously, some of them were. But even many of the Sadducees, in other words, from the priesthood, they became Pharisees. Like Josephus tells us, he was a priest. And he was a Pharisee. You know, he switched sides. Because, obviously, people who want to be faithful to the law of God and to see what the Sadducees have done with it, you know, they just say, well, I cannot accept you as my spiritual leader because you're perverting the scriptures. And so they were not trusted. And so Jesus Christ told them, you really don't know the scriptures, know the power of God. But in contrast, he said about the Pharisees, they are the ones who sit in the seat of Moses. They are the ones who teach the law. Listen to them. Just don't follow their example. You see, there's a difference between one and the other. They were teaching the law of God. They understood it. And Christ never spoke against their understanding of the Passover, or for that matter, you know, the majority of what they taught in terms of the law of God. You see? He could trust them very well and acknowledge them and accept their role in that office because they were faithful in the teaching of the law. And what they were not faithful is that they have added to it, and it's an addition that generally he was aiming at. That was not of God. Not the law itself that they were teaching. And that's why he could say very plainly in Matthew 23. You know, they've got throughout their chapter, you know, they've got their hypocrisy and their problems. You know, they preach what they don't do. But the reality was what they preach was true in terms of the law of God. And so he said, well, they sit in the seat of Moses, and whatever they tell you in terms of the law of God, you better do it. You know, that do, because that came from me. That came from God. Just don't follow their example. You see, and people in their ignorance just threw the whole thing out of the window because he condemned them. And so they said, well, we can't trust them on anything. That's not what Christ said. You got to listen to what he said. And people don't. They just want to hear what they want to hear. And that's all there is to it. And so the controversy was based on this misunderstanding. And the Pharisee understood it properly, and Christ sided with them. Otherwise, he would have said, well, you Pharisees, you don't understand the Passover either. You see? He never said a word about it. The disciples never said a word about it for decades to come after that. You see? There was never any controversy there about that. And so they understood that on the morrow of the Sabbath means on the morrow of the Sabbath. The annual Sabbath, not the weekly Sabbath. You see? And then, when you continue to the book Joshua, you know, the next leader of Israel, you see the fulfillment of this statement. When you come into the land, you know, as God said in verse 10, speak to the children of Israel when you come into the land. Well, now they come to the land, the book of Joshua, 40 years later, and enter into the land. And what do we read here in Joshua? And so we read in chapter 5 in the book of Joshua, right before they were to conquer Jericho, in verse 9, first they had to circumcise. That's what God told Joshua to do. In other words, they have to be clean before they appear before him, before they can eat the Passover. You see, he allowed them, that is the generation that was born in the wilderness, to go without. But in verse 9 he said, then the Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you, which was the lack of circumcision among them, contrary to the law. Therefore, the name of the place is called Gilgal to this very day. Gilgal means to turn. From that comes the word Galgal today, a wheel, you know, that goes around and around. And then we read in verse 10, now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal. Now they are in the land. And kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight, that means Ben Arba'im, at dusk, on the plains of Jericho. So now they are in the land. And they ate, verse 11, and they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover. You see? Because the first day of the Passover season of the seventh day was a Sabbath. And so they ate the produce of the land on the morrow after the Sabbath, just like God commanded in Leviticus. And so it says, and the eighth of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, you see, in other words, after the Sabbath, the first Sabbath, the first annual Sabbath, we're not talking about the weekly one, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. And then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land. And so the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. You see? And that's what the verses were saying. The story has always been plain, and there is no need to pervert it, and that's exactly what the Sadducees were doing. And some people, to this very day, are doing it, again, having the same understanding the Sadducees had, which is a faulty understanding. They think that it's talking about the weekly Sabbath, and they do not consider the context. They fail to consider the context. It's not talking about the weekly Sabbath. The Sabbath is already spoken of in the beginning of the chapter. Now we're into the Passover, and the Passover is two Sabbaths, the first and the one on the seventh day. And so when God says here on the morrow of the Sabbath, the context tells you very plainly what he's talking about, the Sabbath that is on the 15th, because it's the day of cessation of work. And that's why when you go later on to the Septuagint, that was very much used in the days of Christ and long and before that, obviously. And there, realizing that, you know, the misunderstanding here that people may have, especially because of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, that is, and also the Samaritans did not properly understand it. And so they basically translated it. When the 70 translated the Septuagint, that is called the Septuagint, the 70, translation of the 70, every single one of them wrote exactly the same. On the morrow of the first day. You see? In other words, when you read Leviticus 23 and verse 11, you read, and in the day, that is, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you on the morrow of the first day. And the reason why they did it on the morrow of the first day, because the Sabbath that was spoken of here was on the first day of the Passover season. You see? And so people, what I would really understand exactly what it is in all the languages that it was translated to, they just made it very plainly, on the morrow of the first day. So people would realize this is the Sabbath he's talking about, the first Sabbath. And then when you go to the Targum, which is the Aramaic translation, there it says very plainly, on the morrow of the Pesach, or the Pascha, in Aramaic. You see? And that's what we read in Joshua. In Joshua, they fulfilled this statement here, that when they come to the land, they are going to get first, you know, the produce of the land, and they are going to offer it before God, bring it to the priest, on the morrow of the Sabbath. And so Joshua makes it very plain, that the morrow of the Sabbath that God was talking about is on the morrow of the Passover. What does it mean on the morrow of the Passover? Well, the Passover was on the 14th at even, and a holy day is from even to even. And that whole period of time of 24 hours was also a Sabbath, the first day. You see, that's the first Sabbath of the Passover. Passover has two Sabbaths. And if it happens to fall on either side of the weekly Sabbath, you end up with three of them. Three Sabbaths. You see? There you have the two Sabbaths of the Passover and the weekly one in between. And so this is what he's talking about here. And obviously, to this very day, a lot of people have confusion because they do not consider the whole matter. You see? Just like the proverb says, he that does not consider the whole matters, or he that speaks before he considers the whole matters, you know, he's considered to be a fool. A lot of us have made fools out of ourselves many times in our lifetime when we speak before we know all the facts. And unfortunately, that's what happens with a lot of people that study the Bible. You see, the Bible is not just something that you read and you say, well, I know what it says. No, the Bible is something that you study, you research, you go very deeply into it, you consider the whole matter, you put it all together, and then you understand it. So you need to know not only what it says, but what it means. And the Pharisees, as Christ said, not understanding the Scripture properly, not dealing with it properly, not teaching it rightly to begin with, you see, they did not understand the Scriptures. Why? Because they didn't do it right. And it's not enough just read it. You have to study it and know what it means, not only what it says. And had to consider the context, and what Joshua made it very plain, that it was on the morrow of the Passover, You see, in the scriptures that were prevalent at the time that everybody was using, including Christ and the apostles, the Septuagint, which made it very plain, it was on the first day, and the Targum, you know, the Aramaic that said it on the morrow of the Passover. So the overwhelming majority of the evidence, you see, was there to make it very plain. It's the first Sabbath of the Passover. It's not talking about the weekly one. Well, those who have not considered all these things, obviously to this very day, they have this controversy. And as Muhammad said many times in his Quran, for those who read it, and probably some of you are going to be from the faith of Islam who are going to listen to this Bible study, that's why I mentioned now and then something about Islam and about Muhammad. He said very thing, you know, this very statement many times. In the day of resurrection, God is going to resolve all of your differences. And that's true. Well, anyway, we're going to conclude with this statement. And this is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.